Our first case for argument is Johnson and Baston versus Depp. Mr. Harjani?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, the conviction of Dale Baston and Michael Johnson are convictions based on conjecture camouflaged as evidence. In the time I have before this Court, I would like to address one issue, and that issue is that the convictions are based on constitutionally insufficient evidence under the Supreme Court's holding in Jackson. At the outset, I would like to point out what is uncontested here. First, it is uncontested that this Court in Kieskowski held that Brian Kellner's testimony was insufficient under the Jackson standard. Second, that the State has conceded that David Wiener's testimony also is insufficient under Jackson. And third, that the State has asked its Court to overrule Kieskowski and find the testimony of James Gilliam probative, even though this Court rejected that testimony in the Kieskowski case. Your Honors, the clear question before this Court today is what is the difference between this case and the case in Kieskowski, where the Court affirmed a grant of writ of habeas corpus and rejected Gilliam's testimony and Kellner's testimony under the Jackson standard? Well, let's talk about Wiener's testimony. Wiener allegedly saw Baston.
I don't understand that. Are you saying his testimony was a physical impossibility, or just that you wouldn't have believed it?
Your Honor, we have a two-pronged argument in that respect. At the outset, if you find Wiener credible, his testimony that he saw Baston and Johnson carrying something is insufficient under Jackson. And secondly, that no rational trier fact could believe Wiener.
Why?
Your Honor, the reason here that we submit this argument, and the reason why this is different than every other case where you have a jailhouse informant or a crook telling a story, is that the State has conceded that his repressed memory story, the story of how he came to remember Baston Johnson seeing something, is so implausible that no rational trier fact could believe it.
Well, that part of it. Recollection or a statement could be false, but the rest of it could be true.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I would beg to differ. And the reason is this. The testimony about the repressed memory is a very predicate. If the repressed memory is false, then the memory itself is also false.
No. That's just completely illogical. You can give a false reason for why you hadn't said this earlier. You say, oh, I didn't remember it, and all of a sudden I remembered it. So that could be false. You could have known it all along, but you were afraid to testify, afraid to come forward for one reason or another. You didn't.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the question you raised is what the State is certainly arguing in this case. But however, what the State essentially is doing is inventing new facts. They're essentially creating facts in the record that Wiener was somehow afraid of Baston and Johnson, and that is the reason he didn't come forward earlier. At trial, it was submitted that Wiener's testimony, in totality of his testimony, was true, that he came 6 months later, he heard the word Rodale after six shots of bourbon, and he remembered Baston and Johnson carrying something, the word Rodale having absolutely no connection to this case. That's how Wiener testified at trial. That's what the State argued.
But that could be false, and yet his testimony about seeing Johnson and Baston could be true, right?
Your Honor, I would beg to differ respectfully.
No, that's not true. I don't understand you.
I want to provide, for example, a hypothetical. If I were to say that I remember seeing Fred on the corner of Dearborn and Jackson, and I suddenly it's found that I don't have that memory, how can we use that fact then?
That's not a good hypothetical. No. Obviously, if you didn't have the memory, and the point is you could remember something, you could have known something all along, and you lie and you said you forgot it now. I mean, people do that a lot. They say, oh, I forgot. Thanks for reminding me. But actually, they remember, right? That's common.
Yeah. It may be common in the other respects, but in this case, the State submitted Wiener's repressed memory in its totality. And not only do we have the fact of the repressed memory and the admission that no reasonable trial.
But we don't have vouching for a witness anymore. You're not committed to having your case rise and fall on whether your witnesses are believed and are entirely believed.
I certainly understand, Your Honor. But however, let me address the alternative argument we submit. That let's say we find Wiener credible. Let's look at Wiener's testimony of he allegedly seeing Batson and Johnson carrying. We don't know what he was carrying. We don't know what the something was. In fact, let me point out...
Well, we know what the something was. If in fact there was somebody was carrying something, because it's described pretty accurately as it would have been a person, right?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree.
They weren't carrying an Easter basket or something. They were carrying something, and it looked like it might have been non-file.
Well, actually, what we do know, Your Honor, is this. We know that one person was facing backwards and one person was facing forward, and they were hunched over. It was Wiener's conclusion, his inference, that they were carrying something. We don't know if they were carrying anything. Wiener couldn't see them. He could only see them from the waist up. So they were
approximately 6 feet apart.
Approximately 5 to 6 feet apart. That's correct, Your Honor. But they could have certainly been doing anything. They could have been carrying heavy machinery around the paper mill. We don't contest the fact that they were in that area of working that morning. And it's in the record that they regularly carry things around the paper mill.
They both testified, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Did either of them say, acknowledge that they were carrying something?
No, Your Honor, they don't acknowledge that they were carrying anything that day.
So if we were to speculate that they were carrying machinery, it seems that would have been something they would have said.
Your Honor, maybe so, but we are looking at this evidence in the light most favorable to the state. And I am taking it in the most favorable to the state. And let's assume that we have Wiener's testimony. And let's assume Batson and Johnson were walking, facing each other, and Wiener saw them for 3 to 5 seconds. Based on that, the inference that they were carrying Monfield's body without anything more is unreasonable.
Now, what Judge Mannion is saying is if they were carrying something innocuous, why didn't they testify to that?
Well, Your Honor, at trial, Batson and Johnson submitted they weren't carrying anything.
Right.
But now
you're saying they were carrying something. If they were carrying something, well, then they would have said so. You know, they were carrying a...
Well, Your Honor, what we are doing is certainly taking the evidence in a light most favorable to the state. I don't expect this court to certainly parse out who's right and who's wrong. Certainly, that's the jury's function.
But you're not going to get a benefit from taking the evidence most... I don't understand what you're saying.
Your Honor, all we know is that Batson and Johnson were facing each other.
If the evidence is taken favorably to the state, and if one infers from that that Johnson and Batson were carrying something, then their denial that they were carrying anything, of course, is basis for inference of guilt.
Your Honor, I would beg to differ with all due respect. The state has the burden of proof here.
Well, of course it does, but the jury is entitled to draw an inference from denials by a defendant.
That may be so, Your Honor, but the question is whether the inference here was reasonable. And the fact that there was nothing else, no blood stains, no pieces of Monfal's clothing in the area, nothing except the fact that they looked like they were carrying something. Even if the defendant denied it at trial, we still submit that inference is unreasonable. Your Honor, I see my time is up. I'd like to reserve the rest for Mr. Marshall in rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Marshall? Your turn? Oh, okay. Mr. Ballesteri?
May I please the court? I don't really think that the appellant in this case is looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution. I think what he's doing is trying to take something that is out of context and trying to say that this one thing that is taken out of context is insufficient to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. This is not a case of eyewitness testimony. This is not a case where anybody testified that they saw Batson and Johnson kill Tom Monfils, throw him in the pulp sack. This is a case that depended entirely on circumstantial evidence. This was a 5-week trial in which many different witnesses, literally dozens of different witnesses, testified to dozens of different little bits of evidence that had to be put together to come up with a conclusion of guilt. And of course, the testimony of David Weiner, that he saw Bassin and Johnson carrying something in and of itself is not sufficient to prove guilt. I don't think any rational person would suggest such a thing. What you have to do is consider this as a link in the chain of circumstantial evidence. What are the circumstances? Circumstances are that there was a confrontation at approximately 7:35 in the morning between a group of men and Tom Monfils, a group which included Bastin and Johnson. That group of people beat Tom Monfils, beat him very severely, probably to the point where, at least according to some of the testimony of the expert witnesses in this case, he probably would have died without medical attention. So he was very seriously wounded. About 5 minutes after the beating, that's when we have David Weiner observing Bastin and Johnson carrying something. Admittedly, he couldn't see what it was. There was a piece of machinery blocking the view of the lower parts of the bodies of Bastin and Johnson. So he couldn't see what they were carrying, but from their positions, 6 feet apart, Johnson walking backwards, Bastin walking forward, it certainly could have been the body of an adult male.
I assume they were heading towards the vat.
They were heading from the area where the beating occurred, the area where the paper machines were. They were heading in the area toward the vat where the body was found the next morning after the pulp vat was drained. So if you put all of those circumstances together, you come up with, I think, the inescapable conclusion that Bastin and Johnson were carrying Monfils' body to the vat.
I have a question, just because both judges mentioned it. It says, when Bastin was questioned by police, he started to cry and said he did not mean to kill Monfils. Both judges put that in the order, and I couldn't find much else about that. What is that?
There was the...
That's all before the jury, I presume.
Oh, yes. This is testimony that is in the record.
Who said that? Was it a police officer that interrogated him, or who?
You know, I honestly don't recall right now, but my best recollection is that it was... that was stated by the investigating police officer. I do have a citation to that.
Well, the only citation the court did was to some other document that didn't seem to be a testimony. But if you had a citation, I don't know why that both judges mentioned it in one sentence and that's all. It seems to me if somebody, when first interrogated, says something like that, there has to be some impact if a jury hears it.
Yes, I have a citation to that statement in the record at page 14
okay.
in my brief. So,
okay.
So it is in the there is a statement in the record to that effect. As far as whether we are asking this court to overrule Piaskowski, we are not doing that. We're not asking the court to come to any different conclusion about whether there was sufficient evidence to convict Piaskowski or not. What we are saying with respect to the testimony of Mr. Gilliam is that it does not appear, at least from the decision in the Piaskowski case, that this court fully considered all of Mr. Gilliam's testimony recounting Mr. Moore's statements, and that if the court does consider all of the testimony, that it would come to a different conclusion just with respect to Mr. Gilliam's testimony than the court came to in Piaskowski. We have been accused of inventing facts here, specifically inventing facts that Weiner was afraid of Bastin. We have invented no such fact. All of the statements we have made in our brief regarding Weiner's fear of Bastin are supported by testimony in the record. There are citations to all of those. Lastly, I would just say that the court is correct in saying that we don't vouch for the testimony of witnesses anymore. And in fact, I think that the district attorney in this case should be praised for putting in the testimony regarding Wiener's claim of a sudden return of his memory, because that testimony actually hurt the state. As everybody agrees, that testimony was completely implausible. And I think that the district attorney should be praised for his candor in putting in everything that Wiener said and not trying to hide the situation here and just try to put in testimony that, Wiener didn't come forward for 6 months with his testimony because he was afraid of Bastin and just leaving it at that. I think what the district attorney was trying to do was just, as they say, let it all hang out, let the jury make their determination based on all of the evidence, including evidence that that actually hurt their case. The court has no further
Thanks.
Questions. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bellatrix. Mr. Marshall, how much time do you have? 6 minutes?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Mr. Balestrada has told you that the case against Michael Johnson, the case which justifies proof beyond a reasonable doubt under the standard of Jackson, is that there was a confrontation at which Brian Kellner and Brian Kellner alone says that Johnson was there but attributes no role to Johnson there. Secondly, that someone beat John Files during that confrontation, but as this court has already held in Piaskowski, there is no evidence whatsoever that anyone besides Kutzka and Hearn took part in that. And with all respect to Mr. Balestrera, he has explicitly asked the court to overrule Piaskowski and to hold that Gilliam's testimony establishes Johnson's role in the beating. Why? Because without establishing Johnson's role in the beating, all that he has on Johnson and all that he has on Bastin is the fact that Kellner says they were a group that watched the beating, and then Wiener says, with all of the problems with Wiener, Wiener says that he saw somebody walking, one of them walking backwards for 3 to 5 seconds, not very close to the vat, but in the general direction of the vat, and he didn't say he knew they were carrying anything, he didn't say he saw they were carrying anything, he said they looked like they might have been carrying something. So I ask you, Your Honors, does proof beyond a reasonable doubt, is Jackson v. Virginia satisfied when you have evidence that somebody was in a group that watched a confrontation, and then you have somebody who says, with all of the frailties and implausibilities aside for a moment, even if we credit Wiener, that he says, I saw some people walking in that general area, an area where they did walk frequently, an area which was a thoroughfare. Now, it is true, as Judge Mendon asked, did they testify that they were carrying something? No. They had no recall of carrying something, but they did testify that they were in that area. They did testify that they went back and forth from the basement, upstairs, through the staircase that brought them into that general vicinity. Is proof beyond a reasonable doubt the fact that I saw something, which as the court explained to Piaskowski, even if we believe Kellner, being a bystander hardly means being guilty of first-degree murder, and add on to that that someone then sees me walking but never sees me carrying anything, never sees me doing anything otherwise incriminating besides walking in an area. So walking backwards 3 to 5 feet, clearly, if people are walking and talking to each other, and one person turns around for 3 to 5 seconds, that person is walking backwards for that tiny glimpse of time. Is that the evidence upon which these men are going to serve sentences for the rest of their lives? It's not, and that's the reason Mr. Balestrera says you need to overrule Piaskowski. Because if he can put Johnson in the beating, then he says I have a case. But if he can't put Johnson in the beating, or Bastin in the beating, and he can't, unless he overrules Piaskowski, and unless he overcomes the fact that Gilliam was never admitted against Johnson and Bastin anyway, the judge was clear that it wasn't being brought in except as against Raymore, and he has no case, and the inescapable conclusion that he talks about is shameful in terms of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, with respect to, so even if you believe Raymore completely, it doesn't add up to the proof just as Piaskowski didn't come close to adding up to the proof. As for Judge Posner's questions with respect to can't we believe part of it and not other parts, Your Honor, of course we can. But if the court were to engage in that, it would be absolutely eviscerating the right to review.
That's for the jury to do. That's not for us.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
That's for the jury to do, decide how much of a witness's testimony to believe.
It surely is, Your Honor. But, of course, any time that the implausibility issue comes before a court, a jury has already decided to believe something implausible.
We don't deal in implausibility.
Well, Your Honor, with all respect, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you do. Schlick v. Barrow holds that. Anderson v. Bessemer holds that. The state concedes that. Everyone concedes that on sufficiency review, the court is to ignore evidence that is inherently implausible.
Look, you're being very vague. There's implausible, there's inherently implausible, and there's unbelievable. And a lot of things that are implausible are true. They don't sound true. They, you know, you're doubtful about them, but on balance, you think they're true, even though they're implausible.
Indeed, Your Honor. And it is on that note that I also think it's appropriate to respond to Mr. Balestrieri with respect to his claim that how obvious it was that David Wiener was telling a false story. Because in addition to the sufficiency claim here, we have a claim that the jury was entitled to know that the story of repressed memory was implausible. Judge Posner, you say a jury may have decided to believe Wiener nonetheless, to believe he was lying about half of it, but nonetheless to correct the rest of the
testimony. Of course, these people who testify in cases like this are usually lying, aren't they?
Well, Your Honor,
you may believe that.
Your Honor, I certainly hope that's not typically the case. That most prosecution witnesses
are lying. There is a good deal of lying in testimony in all cases, criminal and civil, and judges and juries have to pick their way through a minefield.
And they
succeeded with lies.
And they picked their way
and
through.
You never believe a witness in his entirety.
And they picked their way through by the defense being allowed to present testimony, in this case, expert testimony. In the Bethesh case, you held, Your Honor, that the reason that there was no constitutional violation is because the witness, the defendant, had not tried to put on an expert to educate the jury about the effect of demeanor. Here, the defense wanted to put on a witness to pick apart David Wiener, the case upon which Mr. Balestrieri relies, the testimony upon which he relies. The judge said no. We're told now by Mr. Balestrieri it would have been a waste of time because everybody in the right mind knew that Wiener was lying. Well, Your Honor, we may not vouch for witnesses, but a jury is being told by the state, here is testimony, and being asked to credit it, and the defense has no right to put on an expert scientific evidence to say that's not how repressed memory has worked in all of our studies of repressed memory. So we believe that the court should reverse here on sufficiency of the evidence, even if it wants to accept David Wiener. But at the very least, the court needs to reverse for a new trial, because if a case is going to rest on David Wiener, the defendant had a fundamental right to put on the key to his defense, which was that Wiener was lying, and to ask the jury, once it accepted Wiener was lying, to reject the entirety of Wiener's testimony. You said the jury may not have done that, but the jury clearly could have done that. Many juries would have done it, and that error cannot be dismissed as harmless.
Before you go, would you just answer the one question I had before on the other side, and that's the both judges saying when Baskin was questioned by police, he started to cry and said he did not mean to kill Monfils. Where did that come in?
That comes in through Sergeant Winkler's testimony, and here's what he said happened. And it's a distortion, a mistake by the lower court.
Both judges said exactly the same thing.
It's a mistake, Your Honor. Here's what was said. They asked him, Winkler asked Monfils, you didn't mean to, asked Baskin, you didn't mean to kill Monfils, did you? Answer, no, I was just there helping Johnson. It wasn't that he broke down crying and said, I didn't mean to kill him. You didn't mean to kill him. No, I was just there helping Johnson. That's not an admission. That's an exculpatory statement. I had nothing to do with anything. No, I was just there helping Johnson. And to make that and equate that with an admission,
helping Johnson do what?
He was there helping Johnson with the Measure X. That's why he was there. The computer with the paper stock in number 7, number 9 coupe was down. That's why Baskin was there. That's why Johnson was there. These weren't Johnson's friends. He wasn't on the same union. These weren't people he hung with. He was called there because there was a paper stock problem. Nobody says that he was angry. Connie Jones doesn't say that Johnson was particularly angry or that Baskin was. These weren't even their friends or people. There was a group that got agitated. No one says Johnson and Baskin were part of it. The only reason that Johnson and Baskin are in this case is because of David Wiener. Yet the state admitted that David Wiener wasn't ever enough to make a case. They admitted today he's not enough to make a case. And indeed, what happened when you read the record here is quite clear, Your Honors, and that is that David Wiener got flanked by the fact that Baskin was interested in exploring what might have happened, the way that hundreds of people were around the mill. And that's how this all came about, and he took what may have been a very innocuous observation of watching Johnson and Baskin walk together, and all of a sudden that became significant. Mm-hmm. Is it suspicious? Is there enough there to say, conceivably, that's what they were doing? Of course, just as in Piaskowski. But although juries are trusted to make these decisions, although state courts are trusted, ultimately, the men's reasonable lives rest in your Honor's judgment. Was this proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Is it reasonable to say that because they were seen walking, not seen carrying something, not seen all
okay,
that sort
okay.
of that?
Thank you, Mr. Mark.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And were you appointed? Were you two appointed?
We're both taking this case on a pro bono basis.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you.
Next case.